Storytelling, when used effectively, can be an incredible tool to catapult your career and business through the relationships that you're able to build. No one embodies this idea quite like John Hill, who turned a passion for language, ideas, and people into a massively successful career and a life as a tech evangelist at places like LinkedIn and now at Techstars. The concept of telling stories, ideas, and values of a business to a global audience in order to boost adoption is now widely known as evangelism, or being a chief evangelist of a certain company or brand. But when John Hill started his career in traditional media, he never imagined where it would lead him. And in this episode, we explore how entrepreneurs, professionals, etc. can leverage this unique storytelling ability and their own stories to build relationships that can move the needle. Welcome to Boardroom Banter. We're happy to have you here for our latest episode. Enjoy. Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, whoever you are, wherever you are. Welcome to the Boardroom Banter podcast. You're joining myself, Sean Karanja, in the boardroom. I am joined by my fantastic co-host, Mr. Boniface Omina, and a special guest. We won't reveal who the special guest is, obviously, you know, just to create a bit of dramatic tension. So, Boniface, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Sean. I'm super, super excited. I've been telling the team how I've really been looking forward to going back to co-hosting with you, tag-teaming on the podcast. It's been since last year, actually.
Yeah.
Before Jan released. Released
our first episode, actually, for the year. Just a week ago, we featured Jonathan Chippendale. Really fascinating chat on the intersection between tech and the fashion industry. I mean, that was such a treat. I had laptop issues, so I joined in from my phone and was just like listening in. The FOMO was so real. I had so many questions. I was just typing in the chat the whole time. Ask him. Oh, what about this? LOL.
Oh, that was fun.
Yeah. But today, I have the pleasure of sitting alongside you to have a chat with someone who works in an industry close to our hearts. For a bit of context, Boniface, Yuri, and I share one interesting thing in common. We've all gone to a bunch of these like entrepreneurship boot camps, accelerators, incubators. Most recently, Boni and Yuri were at the Watson Institute. I myself had gone to Draper University. And so, you know, when we looked up our guest and saw that he works at Techstars, and not only works at Techstars, but is their evangelist, meaning, you know, if someone walks around the street like having a banner, like, I am Techstars, he is Techstars, and has a very fascinating story about how he came to be the, you know, evangelist of Techstars. And what does that even mean? He said some really interesting titles. And our guest today is none other than John Hill. John, welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, Sean, I have to have you come around and introduce me when I go speak on stages around the world. That'd be fantastic.
You know, interestingly, John, back when I was in uni, I was broke and needed to make some money. So one of my side hustles that turned to be really lucrative, both in terms of actual capital and social capital, was being a corporate MC. So definitely when you have talking engagements, I can go hype you up like a wrestler. And in the red corner, we have weighing 200 pounds.
Everyone, and you made me skinnier than I am, but everybody needs a hype person. So that would be fantastic. I'm all in, Sean.
Yeah. So look, John, you are Techstars' hype person, right? So to speak. And for anyone who doesn't know, Techstars is a mentorship-driven seed stage investment program, right? And they've got a global footprint. And to date, hundreds of companies have gone through the Techstars Accelerator. They've built really cool products. So, you know, founders go in there. Let's say Boni and I have an idea. We go in there, battle it out, and, you know, come out with a supporting global network of entrepreneurs, mentors, and investors. So it's a really, really incredible part of the global startup ecosystem. So anyone who's building something knows Techstars. And you're the guy who is their ultimate hype man. And I'm really curious just to know, John, if you were to basically describe your work to a 10-year-old or, you know, someone who's a bit younger, might not understand anything about this whole space. How would you explain what you do on a day-to-day?
Yeah, so I am the evangelist, and that's a fancy term for storyteller. And I, on behalf of the 4,000 companies that have gone through Techstars, have the opportunity to speak their journeys, and both manifesting in success and sometimes failure, which if you're in the tech entrepreneurship space, it's where you learn. I, on behalf of the organization, I speak at tech conferences, I speak in ecosystems, I speak at the top universities around the world, and in essence, trying to do two things out of this role, which is generate branding and awareness. So showcase to as many people as possible who we are and what we're about. And also, we're looking for the best companies on the planet. And so I help feed the funnel for the next generation of companies that come into our accelerators. And it's one of the most enjoyable jobs I could ever think of having. I every day get to work with the best entrepreneurs on the planet. And it's really hard to not look at that as just an amazing role. I never really feel like I have a job. I have a passion and a mission, and it's driven through the opportunity to support the best innovators out there. And I get to do things like this. It's kind of mind-blowing to me. First 7.5 years that I was at Techstars, I was VP of network. So I cross-connected 9,000 founders and participants, 12,000 mentors, 23,000 investors, corporate partners, community leaders, on and offline. In essence, built the alumni network for accelerators. Prior to that, I worked at a little company you may have heard before called LinkedIn. I was infused on a product team working with universities, and I was also an evangelist at LinkedIn. So one of the rare people who have had that title twice.
Wow, so much to unpack here, John. You sound and look like you really enjoy the work that you do. I think one thing that we love about this podcast, speaking for Sean and myself, it allows us to step into a lot of the gifts, skills, and abilities that we've really been honing and cultivating over the course of our lives. And this just goes back to, you know, I could just draw from an example of my own childhood. I grew up in a big family, in a very open kind of household. So, you know, very talkative, you know, you could very openly express your opinion without fear of judgment, and so on and so forth. And so I think what this built in myself is a certain aspect through which, or a certain way through which I approach social context and even in the work that I do. And this is one thing that we love to find out about our guests. For us to understand who you are today and the work that you do, what do we need to know about your early childhood experiences and some of the places and environments that really shaped who you are today?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I grew up in a medium-sized family in the U.S., oldest of three siblings. My dad was a non-traditional university student, so he actually got his master's degree while he had me and my sister, while he was working full-time. And so I think there's a piece of what he was that to be able to balance all that in a young family, you always try to live up to where he was able to go. He ultimately ended up working in the automotive industry. So we moved a lot as well. And I think that opened up the door for me to connect and engage with people. I'm Irish by heritage, so we have the gift of the gab. So I love talking to people. I'm definitely an extrovert. And I think it showed when I was young and continues to this day. I've never met a stranger. And it's one of the beautiful things about entrepreneurship. It's a small world. And so it's really easy to meet somebody through somebody else. And if you have that ability to have conversation with anybody, it opens up the door everywhere. And I think, you know, again, that vantage point that I had when I was younger, when I was in essence a geographic mutt, like I wasn't living in one location at any given time, It made it easier for me to look at the world as a much smaller place than I think most people do. And the good fortune I've had since then is I've been able to travel the world working within ecosystems everywhere from Cape Town, South Africa to Singapore to Abu Dhabi to Norway to Portugal, and connecting with people. And it's been just one of those rides that when I look back at it, probably started with us being transient and moving when I was younger.
That's really interesting. So, by virtue of that almost nomadic lifestyle and career, I'm really curious to understand some of the trends, current affairs, etc., that today are shaping some of your work and passions. Because, I think by virtue of you talking to various people, audiences, even just seeing such a huge amount of startups pass through Techstars and go out and just make a dent in the universe, I'm sure there's a couple of trends or, current affairs or just directions that you're seeing the world is going in that are piquing your interest right now. What are some of those things for you?
I think one of the benefits of working specifically with early stage tech companies is you get to view the world 2 to 5 years from now, because whatever they're developing, whatever products and service they're developing, won't be normalized until at a minimum that period of time. So you're getting to see a glimpse of the future, which makes it just an unbelievably rewarding job to have. And I'm a huge fan of surrounding yourself with the people you want to be. Also putting yourself in rooms where you're not the smartest person in the room. And literally within the Techstars world, I'm the dumbest person in every room I walk into. And I say that knowingly and in an enjoyable fashion, because I'm sitting around these people who are literally changing the way that we're going to enact our lives. And it's one of the things that's kept me at Techstars for 10 years is the entrepreneurs haven't changed from 10 years ago to today. Now, the technology, the trends, as you're talking about, have changed in that time period. But the entrepreneurs, like that spirit, who they are and what they're about, has not changed in the entire decade that I've been here.
Yeah,
And
let's unpack that a bit. What do you mean by that?
What it takes to be successful in a non-traditional professional career path, like entrepreneurship, right? You can go into corporate, university, government jobs. Those are all pretty similar to, like the similar space. If you're in entrepreneurship, you're unique to begin with, and you have some unique skill sets because you're working out of essentially a shadow labor force. You're working in the non-mainstream. You're taking your professional work on hard, by the way. Like being a entrepreneur is one of the hardest things on the planet to do. But when I look at the characteristics of the entrepreneurs that I saw a decade ago, they hold true today. Like the entrepreneurs I work with are resilient. They're adaptable. They're competitive. They are curious. And that is fun to be around. And again, I've been doing that for a decade, which has made I think my life richer because of it. And again, it goes back to not feeling like you have a job. I feel like I'm in this path of continuing education through every engagement I have with the Techstars founder.
Sean, did you wanna add something?
Yeah, no, I think that's just, he's blowing my mind right now. But yeah, that's really, it's really cool that things don't change. I mean, fundamentally, entrepreneurship is high risk, high reward. It takes a certain underlying set of character traits and interests and skills to, for you to be successful. So yeah, I'm just gonna keep that in mind.
Do you think you've changed as an entrepreneur, Sean, from the time you were Draper, for instance, to how you are now? I can answer the same question, but I think there is
Do
that.
I think I've changed as an entrepreneur? I'd say yes and no. Yes, because I think I'm a lot more measured about expectations in terms of, okay, you start something, when am I going to start seeing results? I'm a lot more measured about that. Like, okay, this isn't gonna go off overnight and you know, become an instant hit. And it's actually, it's gonna take longer than I think, but that time will elapse faster than it will feel. That's one thing that I'm coming to learn. And I'd say no, I haven't changed in terms of like, man, I'm still like super optimistic. I think my optimism hasn't changed over the years. So while I'm a lot more pragmatic about the risks I take and the opportunities that, you know, I pursue, just a bit more data driven about that. Not just building a business, because Bonnie and I talked about it in a dorm room. I mean, that's how Boardroom Banter came about.
Boardroom Banter,
we're in a parking lot. But, you know, I think that optimism has still stuck around. Yeah. What about you, Bonnie?
I was doing an application this past week for a program in Ireland, actually. It's a program with Jameson. And there were some essays that I had us do, you know, all the good stuff, you know, who are you and why do you want to be here? And they had us do a 2-minute video, again, talking about why we want to be part of the program. And I think, to answer your question, Sean, I think how I tell my story as an entrepreneur has changed. Because when I was applying to Watson, for instance, I really focused on, this is what I've accomplished, you know, this is, you know, these are all of these, you know, I've checked all the boxes and all that. When I was doing this 2-minute video, I did it in like the middle of the night, like 2 a.m. The whole house was quiet. I had nice lighting in the dining room. And so what I did, I just ended up talking about the people and communities that I've been a part of over the years. And the reason for that, and let's go back to what you mentioned, John, about this ecosystem that we're in and how, you know, the world ends up looking much smaller than it actually is. I think I like how the approach I took with the video, because even the photos that I put and the things that I spoke about were just very authentic to me and have nothing to do with necessarily like the work that I've done. I'd love to understand this from you, John. What is your relationship with storytelling and the work that you do? And why would you coin it as a very important skill for entrepreneurs to have, being able to package themselves and tell their story and shape their own narrative?
Yeah, so nobody cares about your story as much as you do as an entrepreneur. So nobody's going to be able to tell the story as well as you can. And so that's something to keep in mind on that front. You, as an entrepreneur, are also given a stage that you can give people permission to view what the future looks like. Right? If you think about any entrepreneur or founder, what makes them so special? One, they're rare to begin with. You're already a unicorn before you try to become a unicorn. Most people will not be entrepreneurs. And the saying I always love about entrepreneurship, it's like jumping off the cliff and trying to build a plane before it hits the ground. You know, it's not a journey for the meek, right? But any entrepreneur has this uncanny ability to suspend disbelief and do something that nobody else in the world has done, or try to do something better. And that's a gift. And I think when I look at that gift, where it really becomes accentuated is when people can also tell a story that brings along other people with them on the ride, and evokes emotion around, you know, technology, which is not an easy thing to do. Most of the world is transactional. When you can create transaction and emotion and intersect them together, it becomes special. And irony to like the role of an evangelist, the first evangelist was Guy Kawasaki, who evangelized for Apple. And Apple,
really,
arguably,
really awesome guy.
Yeah, and Apple, arguably the best organization and company in telling stories. It just happens to have a product that comes along with it. And so they evoke emotion around technology. That is one of the most powerful things you can do. And that's what I try to do for Techstars. That's what I try to do with the entrepreneurs that we're working with, showcase that this isn't just about making money. It's about changing and transforming people's lives. And that's the power of storytelling, is when you can get people to attach into that emotion, because one, it's real and visceral, and two, it showcases why we are doing what we're doing. And in our case, you know, why we're the largest early seed stage tech investor in the world, because we know it's important.
That makes me feel so much confident about my application, John.
I have fingers crossed.
That's awesome. How about, I'm just thinking to, you know, my founder's journey, and a big part of putting your product out into the world is creating a narrative around, number one, the problem that you're trying to solve, but also the solution that you're building and why it's so effective. From all the founders that you've seen and all the different brands and organizations and communities you've interacted with that have their own unique narratives, what would you say are some of the common mistakes or pitfalls, or maybe areas that, you know, these individuals or organizations may be lacking in terms of how they put their stories across?
Yeah, I think there are three things that I could speak about this. You know, number one, there are, again, I get to work with some of the brightest people on the planet. Many of those people are engineers. Engineers like to build. But sometimes you build without the audience in mind. So if you haven't worked with the customer, there's potentially not a market for what you're building, and there's misalignment. So, like, I think that that's one piece. You know, the build of a company is very intimate, and you know, not unlike a marriage in some way between co-founders. And so that misalignment with co-founders is another thing that I think is a common mistake that I see with companies. They're just not the right partners. I think the last has to do with the ability to solicit funding and solicit the right funding, or make the decision to not solicit funding and just try to bootstrap. And I think, like, that's a challenge as well. And, you know, like, money ultimately is the downfall for most, whether it's people not paying for product and service, or the investment not coming in on one side. And then I think with all companies on the success metrics, anybody has to show appreciable traction, scale, right? They've got to be able to showcase that they can grow it. There's a market to go after, and they're up and to the right on growth metrics. You know, like, when you think about those mistakes, I think those are like the three that really stick out to me.
Yeah, go ahead, John.
Yeah, no, I love it. I love it. That was so practical. I even just, like, noted it down.
Yeah.
You know, one thing I'm liking about John, I guess, just as a communicator, I'm just finding this conversation just, like, hits straight to the point. So to our listeners who are following this, like, if you have a notebook, I'm pretty sure you have very structured notes at this point. So I think, John, that's one more thing I'd add to your advice in terms of how you put your story across. Like, keep what needs to be upfront. You know, don't go around the bush too much. Because I think also on the flip side of wanting to have an effective story, there's also that pitfall of too much storytelling. Like, this is now just a story. You know, what happened to the metrics, or what happened to the important data that you're trying to put across? Thanks for being concise and just living up to that.
So I graduated with a journalism degree and a history minor. My dad said I was allergic to money. but as a journalist, you understand the importance of what's called the inverted pyramid of writing. So you put the things that are most important at the top and then tailor it down from there. So somebody can cut out the story midway through and you still get the quintessential germ of what's important.
New year, new me. Sounds familiar? Well,
One of our goals as podcast hosts has been to get deeper into our bags. And a key part of that is learning about diversifying our income and investments. This episode is sponsored by Apex, a cryptocurrency exchange that understands the importance and increasing complexity of investing in the 21st century. And they make it easier and simple to make your first step. Explore the world of opportunities with Apex today.
Speaking of your degree in journalism, we came across a very interesting piece of information about your 20s, John.
Oh no, I don't even want to know what this is.
When you were 23, you managed multiple reporters who were in their 30s.
Yeah.
And we have some people in our podcast community who are finding themselves stepping into such roles, right? Multi-generational workspaces, because of how they've matched their skills together, they find themselves in positions where they're leading teams with people much older than them. This wasn't part of the discussion guide, but I'm very curious to understand how you navigated this, because one of the challenges that some of us face at this age is, you know, being undermined in the workplace, feeling like, you know, that, oh, years of experience is more important than, you know, whatever capacity you have to deliver in your role. How did you navigate that workspace, John?
Yeah. And so what you're referring to, I did a post on LinkedIn talking a little bit about my past. And if you go through my LinkedIn posts, you'll see that I'm super authentic. And, you know, you've been with me for 20 minutes, 30 minutes now. You can see I'm the same as I am in the post there. And I try to be authentic because I think that there's a lot of content out there where it's, you should be this, and everybody's not this, right? You are you, right? And the authenticity of you is what's important. And so I can share some of my stories, and if you align with my stories, you come along with the journey with me. Like, we can figure out how to connect on other things downstream. And I also give people permission to be vulnerable, which I think is important in a process like being an entrepreneur, which can be very lonely and mentally taxing. And you have to have levels of vulnerability in the process. So I interviewed for a sports writer position at a paper in just south of Nashville, Tennessee. And before I started the role, the editor of the paper called me and said, "Hey, you interviewed for a reporter position, but I'd like to make you editor. And are you interested?" Sports editor for the sports section. They offered me no more pay than I was making as a sports writer, and three times the responsibility. And I said yes. And I think like that was the beginning of understanding the importance of taking risks and like pushing through pain to continue to grow as a professional. In that post, I mentioned that I was going to my first day of work, knowing that I was going to be leading a team of people who are much older than I was, also leading people who are peers to me age-wise, but I was going to be their superior in that role. And I literally opened the door to my apartment, took two steps out, and I threw up. And I threw up because of nerves. In that moment, like, your body's having this really drastic reaction. You have to sit and think, oh, wow, can I do this? And I put one foot in front of the other, got in the car, drove to the newspaper, and started my career there. 8 months later, I was named editor for a national sports magazine. And, had I not taken that risk, I wouldn't have had that opportunity. Through that sports editor opportunity, I did radio shows all over the country. So it opened up the door for me to be comfortable in environments like this or on stage And one of the things that you'll see it with me as a speaker, if you catch me at a conference or speaking at an accelerator or university, is my storytelling style is like this. It is authentic because I feel like all these people are in my living room, but there's no way I would have been able to grow to the point of comfortability giving stories on behalf of places like Texas or LinkedIn if I wouldn't have taken those extra steps to take that leadership position that day. And so like, that sticks in my head as I'm thankful I pushed through whatever, you know, momentary discomfort I had at that time.
So what I'm hearing here is that to be a great storyteller, number one, you have to be authentic, but also it takes storytelling to build storytelling. It's like a muscle, sure, of sorts, right?
Yeah.
And I'd like to boil this down to, you know, a more interpersonal type of level where on a day-to-day we're meeting people, we're talking to people, and especially for some of us who are young professionals or you know, budding entrepreneurs, we have to do a lot of networking.
Mm-hmm.
And at the core of all of those things is just building relationships. So how does storytelling now come into our day-to-day lives when it comes to building those relationships and networking also? How do we create those narratives around who we are? You know, we hop onto this podcast, John, that like we had to introduce ourselves to each other, like, hey, I'm so-and-so, or I'm so-and-so, or you meet someone at a mixer somewhere after work. Who am I? You know, how do we start to navigate those little things as we build relationships?
Yeah. So I'll step back a second. Everybody has a story. And if told right, and told at the right time to the right people, it's engaging and opens up the door for opportunity. With entrepreneurs, one of the things that I find fascinating is they'll have strategy for go-to-market, or they'll have strategy for product or service development, but they generally don't have strategies laid out in a similar fashion for relationships, which I would argue are the most important thing out there. I have two things that I always share on every talk that I give. One, build a network before you need it, so it's there when you do. And two, build a quality relational network, not a quantity relational network. Now, on that first one, you know, where I can make this relatable to, say, the audience here, say you're working in a specific industry like government, and you haven't built any relationships outside of government, and then all of a sudden those jobs dry up, you're going to have to redefine yourself as a professional and build a network to find the next roles, because you only built relationships within government or corporate or whatever, you know, nonprofit or whatever, right? And so you have to build like a wide array of relationships to support and help you out, but they have to be also quality relationships. And by the way, on that first one, how I make a corollary for entrepreneurs is if your first connection with an investor is asking him for money, you failed, right? You need to start building the relationship ahead of time so you're qualified deal flow, so that they're there when you need them. On the second front, build a quality relationship. I actually learned that from a book that Reid Hoffman, who invented LinkedIn, wrote called The Startup of You. And in that book, he tried to map out the most important relationships we have that create opportunity. And he found that 85% of job opportunities through relational networking came out of not who you know, first level connection, but who they know, connection of a connection, second level connection. And from an entrepreneurial perspective, I'd say your business development, your sales, your investment opportunities, it's not about who you know, it's about who they know that opens up the door to opportunity, connection of a connection. But at that first level, if you built quality relationships through friends and family, university, shared work experience, anything that you do to support yourself professionally, groups, associations, conferences, if you built a quality network there, it gives you access to that second level where the vast majority of opportunity lies. And so, you know, people from a company perspective aren't thinking about utilizing a strategy to navigate relationships. And then certainly they're not thinking about it from an individual level, not in the way that we're talking about this in a very structured manner right now. But I'd argue your best opportunities are going to come out of the people who know you. And you know, like we earlier, before we started this podcast, talked about Steve Cadigan. For all those people here, Steve was the VP of HR for LinkedIn, helped scale the company in the early days, which was literally a rocket ship. It was the fastest growing company I've ever been a part of. And so I can only imagine the learning curve he had to do what he did. He is now advising, say, you on this podcast, but he's also become this thought leader and subject matter expert out in the space. He wrote a book called Workquake, talking about the changing dynamics of the workforce, stuff like that. But the reason that he has been successful as an individual brand is that he had relationships and good credibility through things like LinkedIn. And if you meet him, he's just a great human being. And so you want to be a part of his world. You want to connect with him, right? And I think like people don't think about how they position themselves professionally enough. And again, I think a lot of people just want to go to work and do 9 to 5 or whatever hours in their respective countries and then go home. There is a smaller subset of people who want to do things a little bit differently, and then even smaller subset that can actualize relationships to create opportunities, not only for themselves, but for other people.
That's so crazy. I'm going to write that on my whiteboard behind me. Because a lot of times we do focus on the first layer of interaction and who they are and the doors they can open. But even, you know, as you were speaking, I was thinking back to some of the opportunities I've gotten. And you're right. It's actually that someone that I knew in my network or a mentor or someone who, you know, I had developed a really good relationship with knew someone else who was actually the actual gatekeeper at the end of the day. That's really fascinating. I hope whoever's listening is really like beeping all of this. Boniface.
Yeah. John, you referenced Workquake. That's the book that Steve gifted us when we met him in Silicon Valley in 2022. And so for those who don't know what Workquake is, a book that Steve wrote on the future of work. And two things that stuck out from the book that tie into this conversation is one, he spoke about regarding, it was actually LinkedIn, how, for example, moving from job to job a long time ago was viewed as, you know, you're not stable, or, you know, rather like at that time, working for a company for a long time was seen as a good thing. But with how the world of work is changing, if I work for Bodo and Banda today, and then I work for Techstars, and I work for LinkedIn, over the course of 5 years, I've built networks in these spaces. And so because of my networks, that is an asset. And that's one of like the most profound things that I read in the book. And the other one was how companies should cultivate their alumni networks, right? Just because someone left your company doesn't mean, okay, now they're persona non grata, you know, they're not, you know, cut off from the company anymore, but it's good to cultivate alumni networks for companies, because these are people who can be your evangelists, the people who can be refer people back to you, you know, talent. They can come back years later in different positions. And I think this conversation is very valuable for people stepping into their early careers, right? Whether entrepreneurs, regardless of which career you're in. And tying back into something that you mentioned as well, in the best time to build a network is at university level. And that's a lot of the value that we've seen when we started the podcast, when we were in university, right? A lot of the ways in which we've been challenged in our thinking, a lot of the ways we've been challenged to really step out of our comfort zone and step into conversations such as this and ask the question that we're asking is a result of all this. So yeah, just I'm happy that we're seeing a lot of alignment in this conversation.
Yeah, Bonnie, it actually takes me into a couple different places that I think are interesting, and it also shows how small the world is. Steve is alluding to, in what you're saying right now, something that Reid Hoffman and his co-writer of another book, Ben Casnocha, talked about, which was relating to tour of duty in the workplace. Now, Ben, just to tie this back to Techstars, was an associate, so worked in the first Techstars program in Boulder in 2007, and then downstream wrote a book with Reid Hoffman, who invented LinkedIn, and I've worked in both those places around both those people, which is, you know, small world type thing.
You cannot make this up. You cannot make this up, kids.
So, but what they were referring to with tour duty is there's a promise by the employer to get you positioned for, in essence, what Jeff Weiner, who was the president of LinkedIn, talked about, your next play. So like your next position, whether that's within the company or not. And the promise by the employee was to do everything to fulfill what the expectation was within the workplace, right? And if done well, that person gets a better opportunity in the next iteration of their professional career. And that was the idea of like tour of duty. Now, if you think about organizations like Techstars or LinkedIn, we're credibility lenses. So if you work at LinkedIn, it's a credibility lens that you were able to get into that environment to work there. And at the time I was there, it was arguably the hottest company in the world. At Techstars, if you are able to get your company in, like, that's such a credibility lens because it's so difficult to get into one of our accelerators. And so thinking about those credibility lenses, and I'll play it both from a Techstars perspective and an individual professional and a corporate side. If I end up leaving a company, it makes sense to create an alumni connection and an engagement back into the brand because I can become a boomerang hire, which means that I've already been vetted. It's easy to hire me back into the organization. You don't have to go through as much vetting with HR. I can offer opportunities for things like business development. So you can sell into the company I'm in now, and you have somebody who's a trusted source to engage with in that, that can help with like proof of concept, that can help with A/B testing. I can be a purveyor of messaging on behalf of the organization and showcase information I hear through the alumni network into my respective professional networks and essentially become an extension of branding and awareness. On the Techstars side, you know, when we're talking about alumni networks, you go through this 13-week accelerator. You're surrounded by mentors and investors, knowledge share, and then we spin you out into the world. It makes sense for us as an organization to put our arms around all of those entrepreneurs long-term. And if they exit, if they fail, we want them to roll back into the next generation of entrepreneurs for investment, for mentorship, for knowledge share, for subject matter expertise, right? And so again, that's tapping into the alumni network to support the next generation of people. And on the corporate side, tapping back into it for opportunities to grow, scale, develop your organization. And a lot of people are short-sighted on both sides, right? It's transaction, I give you money, expectation is you succeed, or I give you a job, you leave, that's the end of the contract and relationship. And the people who do these type of relational networks most effectively realize that this is for life. And if you can create extension and engagement for life, and by the way, this works with individual relationships as well. If you're not keeping your network warm, if you're not supporting and engaging people in your network when you don't need them, they're not likely to be there when you do need them. So keep networks warm from a corporate perspective, from an accelerator perspective, from an individual perspective, because that's an asset. And, you know, if I'll give you an example, like, if I see people in my network moving from one country to another, I'll introduce them to people I know in that country. If I see people starting a new job, and I know people who work at the company they're starting at, I'll introduce them. If I see somebody celebrating something professionally, I will send them an actual direct email instead of like the like button, talking about ways we can work together, or just, you know, give them a pat on the back. I do that about 20 times a day. The course of a year, I'm celebrating people, things in my network about 5,000 times. It's almost formulaic, right? If I reach out to any of those people to help any of the founders from Techstars that I'm trying to engage with, do you think they're more likely to return message? Probably, right? And for me, it's more intuitive, but like all of this can be structured, especially around relationships. And it's always fascinating to me that networks or relationships are always seen as like this nebulous thing, but it's like anything else. If you structure it, you can start to see what kind of action happens on the back end.
Well, I like your data-driven approach to you know, how you're measuring your impact in relationships, but also how they convert into actual opportunities. And I think that's super important. I'm definitely gonna do that. I think one thing I was thinking of doing recently was just having a tracker, you know, simple Excel sheet or something where I say, hey, these are the people in my network who are maybe could be connections for capital or could be connections for ideas, or these are really, you know, badass software engineers that I know, in case, you know, one day I might need to build something, or one day I might need to talk to someone, get a warm intro.
Don't leave us on the podcast, Sean. We still need you.
Hey, Sean, let me layer in on that for a second, because I actually do have some additional insights that I think actually put even more structure to what you're talking about.
Yeah,
so we at TechStars operate a global mentor network. And mentors, we don't pay them. They do it on their own volition. So like they engage back. And I think it's important for people to understand motivations of why people engage in activities like supportive entrepreneurship and that concept of mentorship. But that could be from an individual perspective as well. So the four main reasons that we were able to see through surveys and data of why people mentor, number one was altruism. So they just wanted to give back. And that's the largest bucket. So like supporting and helping you, there is a large bucket of people who just want to help you. No other reason. They're like, it's not transaction. They've been able to get to know you. They respect what you're doing. You know, they can see promise, whatever. So the second one, more relatable to the world that I'm in with early seed stage tech companies and tech stars, they're interested in trends, seeing insight into technological trends. So what the world looks like, again, 2 to 5 years from now, right? So they mentor to keep themselves sharp, so they're ahead of the curve in the space. The third is they're interested in their own opportunities. And there's also a group of people around you that are interested in their own opportunities, board work, committee work, C-level positions for our tech companies. But, you know, you're a vessel for opportunity. And again, if you fulfill that opportunity for somebody, they're likely going to be there when you need them, right? And then the last one for our tech companies is qualified deal flow. I would say from an individual perspective, that's probably jobs and opportunity. Like, you know, like they can offer jobs and opportunities downstream. But they get to know you as a person, it's easier to hire you in an organization, right? Because they've already kind of vetted you out from a personal perspective. So there's some corollary there. I've never really put that together in a very deep way. In fact, that's the first time I've ever said that in that way. But, you know, like there's, it's interesting that, you know, why people engage with tech companies. I think most people wouldn't think about why do people engage with them, right? From an individual perspective. And you can probably bucket why they do. And then if you figure out those buckets, you can communicate accordingly to those groups of people in very similar fashion.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. Incentives rule the world. And at the end of the day, they're also key to a lot of relationships and why people do what they do. John, I'm really interested to know, as we come to the tail end of this conversation, you know, you've been looking, just like you said earlier on, you know, when you work with these early stage startups and these, you know, entrepreneurs on the bleeding edge of a vast majority of things and industries, what are you excited about? Like, just, I mean, it could be in the tech world, it could be just in the world in general. But what's exciting you right now about the future?
Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting. Technology, and especially the view of technology that I can see future forward, is like a roller coaster. It's like hitting that first big hill on a roller coaster. It's both exhilarating and scary as all get out. And, you know, like I can lean back and forth on each one. Like there's parts of technology that scare me to death. So if you have a global view of cultures, communities, people, And I've been blessed with that. And I've had the opportunity to speak in, you know, 30 plus countries, more. The vast majority of people are inherently good. Like, that's just a given. So if you tie what they're trying to do with technology to that thought process, your hope and in reality for me, my expectation is good people are going to build good things that will better society. And so I'm not going to look at it as this space is what I'm excited about, like this vertical, this type of technology. Like, I'm agnostic. It's technology in general. And I'm watching technology in general advance at a very rapid rate. And the people who are trying to bring things to bear are super good people. And at Techstars, as part of the vetting for our entrepreneurs into our accelerators, the first three criteria are team, team, team. It's about the people who are doing these ideas. If I were to say anything to the group of people who are listening to this podcast, it would be that technology feels like it's in good hands for the most part, especially through the lens that I have with Techstars. And I'll kind of leave it at that. We'll say one last thing. Again, go back to entrepreneurs having that ability to suspend disbelief and do something that nobody else in the world has done or do it better, right? That gift. For anybody who's listening to this, keep pushing and, you know, keep on that track. I've had the ability to witness people who are two or three people in a company scale to go public. I've witnessed that journey. I've witnessed people, two or three founders, get acquired for $1 billion. I've literally seen that journey. So, like, the impossible is possible. That includes the individual perspective. I'm an evangelist. I was a network catalyst before this. I was an evangelist before this. Like, nobody even understands my job titles, and yet I've achieved those things that just didn't really exist. And from both that company perspective or the individual perspective, it's okay to dream big and push towards that goal. And set that goal so that you can attain it, because you'll be amazed at how far you'll get towards that journey. And I think, like, I sit here an evangelist twice for two of the hottest companies in the world. I'm the luckiest human on earth in that regard. But, you know, there is a pathway for other people to follow to do what they want to do, to feel that passion and mission that you hear in my voice around what I'm doing for Techstars.
Hey, John, so I'm seeing no AI Terminator timeline on your books, huh?
I'm not too worried about it. So,
awesome. John, I think I speak for the team here in terms of, man, this has been such an introspective conversation, as much as it's been about the exciting world out there, and just the fact that, hey, we and the stories that we believe about ourselves and the world are what create those stories and those exciting futures. And so, yeah, as we get to the end here, we do have an interesting segment for you, John. As an extrovert and a quick thinker, I think you'll do pretty well here. It's called the elevator segment, and I'll let my colleague Boniface lead you into the slaughterhouse.
You know that Dr. Doofenshmirtz laugh? Yeah. John, picture this, right? It's two to 5 years from now, you know, the boardroom is, you know, bigger than it is now. You know, I'm recording this from my sister's room. So picture a 10-story building. 10-story is not too big. 10-story building, you know, we're in the top floor, amazing view of the city of Nairobi. And we're walking out of the boardroom, right? And as you get into the elevator, one of our interns, Sha! Just hops in there with you and has a couple of quick fire questions for you, John. Let me know if you're ready.
Fire away.
All right, let's go. The first question, what is the first thing that you bought with your own money?
Probably a cheeseburger.
Nice job.
I was a teenager, so like I had a I started working when I was 13. I had a newspaper route back in the day when newspapers were a real thing, and I used to deliver the newspaper door to door on a route, and made maybe $30 a week, probably less, but I'm pretty sure one of the first things I bought was food.
Sweet. All right, next question. You mentioned Reid Hoffman earlier. I was listening to his podcast on my way to driving school this morning, and Masters of Scale. If you're listening after this podcast episode, hop on over to Reid's podcast.
Great
And
podcast.
the conversation was on learning from every no. And he actually spoke about LinkedIn. One of the things that you're saying is each no offers a unique opportunity to refine an idea, sharpen a pitch, and foster resilience. It can even be a sign that your idea is so contrarian that it could be truly transformative. The episode is titled Learning from Every No. And so my question to you, John, is if you look back at your life, is there a no that you've ever gotten that in retrospect proved to be one of the best no's that you would ever get? Like it was good that you didn't get a yes in a specific instance.
So first of all, our CEO, Mayal Gave, has been on Reed's podcast for Masters of Scale. So you can take a look for that episode at some point. We had a very interesting engagement with Techstars. They quasi recruited me. So I had a conversation with some of the founders, David Brown, David Cohen, two of the four founders of Techstars in October of 2013. And they were looking at building an alumni network, and I kind of got offered the job. Then in January, I got a call from one of the first people they hired in HR for Techstars. So it tells you how young the organization was at that time. It was a long time ago. The person in HR who I'm still friends with today, and I'm not going to call out by name, said, "Hey, I understand you're interested in interviewing for this position." And I'm like, "I think I've been offered the position." And she's like, "Nope, we're starting a process all over." And so in essence, it was a no for getting the job once. And so I had to go through the whole process again and get the job a second time. I think what it proved out to me, though, was I was the right person at that time for the position that they were creating. And it made me really think about, did I want to leave LinkedIn to go to Techstars? Because I had to go through an extra effort to make it happen. And so, like, that's probably the most seminal no I have. But I also like to reframe no as new opportunity, right? And I absolutely agree that, like, the no's afford you the opportunity to iterate and become better. To the point where if you listen to the critical feedback that's given, that's a gift, and it opens up the door for you to accelerate in a direction that without that input, you might not have done. So I look at no's ex extending your peripheral and letting you see the field in a much broader way.
Love it. Next question. If right now, Boniface, Yuri, like the whole Boardroom Banter team, we've got $10 million to give you, and you have to go and build a startup, which in the next 5 years you must have built to something substantial and cool. Cool factor is definitely something. What would you build, and why?
I do the Richard Branson approach and buy an island and then have all the best entrepreneurs in the world come and hang out at my island and then use it for deal flow and invite all the VC on the other side. So, I think that's what I would do.
That sounds like
So
lots of
I would
fun.
name it Startup Island. We could do a TV show off of it, like
Oh
extend it
yeah.
for a podcast. Right, I'd
You
bring
know
you along for the ride. Let's make it happen.
John, you might be onto something there. You might be onto something. We'll follow up in a later chat. Startup
Sounds good.
Island. Couple of affordable islands this side of Africa. I think out in the Maldives, etc., it's a bit saturated, but I think we can get a good deal out here.
I think that'd be great. Do like an in the round where like startups compete against each other, and
Oh yeah.
we could have a lot of fun.
Definitely. You know what, John? Let's side chat. We'll side chat to you. What's second question? What's the worst advice you've ever gotten?
So I, from somebody I respect, who had lived in a world that was different from the professional world that I grew up in. So we talk about tour of duty, right? 40 years ago, there were legacy employers in places like the US where you could work in one job for 35 years and go all the way through. And I had somebody who was well-meaning tell me that I should just stay in one job as long, you know, like for 35 years. Irony to saying this, you know, like when I look back, I moved pretty quickly into jobs every 3 or 4 years up until I hit Techstars. You know, and the irony there is now I've been at Techstars for a decade, which is not what I was expecting. You know, like I actually think in the interview process at some point I told somebody I'd only be there 3 or 4 years. And I, you know, and here I am a decade later. But you know, that thought process, if I would have done that, I think I know my growth would have been stunted. And I wouldn't be in front of you right now, obviously. And so, you know, I took a series of what I would say are calculated risks, and every risk that I took, it gave me permission to take other risks that led to working at an organization like Techstars or being an evangelist. And you know, there's very little downside. I think people create fear in their head. And you know, some of it is warranted. You may not have the means to get out of where you're at. You know, you're in structures, you're in cultures that make it more difficult to be where you want to go professionally. But I try to not operate out of fear. And that feels like a good place. And when I think back to that, that well-meaning person was essentially telling me to operate in fear, like stay in one place because the rest of my professional life could be scary. And I'm glad that I leaned into that and didn't take bad advice, but said, I'm not going to worry about fear, and operated from that direction.
Wow. We have come to the end of our elevator segment. We like to joke when we have them a bit long that our boardroom is at the top of the Burj Khalifa and we took the stairs. That's why it took so long.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah, John, we want to thank you so much for your time, your wisdom, your humor, and just your presence. I think one of the things that we love as podcast hosts is when a guest is present, when a guest is authentic. And I'd say you've really practiced what you've been preaching. And we are walking away from this conversation knowing that authenticity, grit, and, you know, optimism about the future is the way to go when we think about how to build relationships towards our futures or how to build really awesome startups. So I think Techstars have a really, really amazing find in you as their evangelist, and it all makes sense. Might try and look for a job at Techstars now. Sounds like they, if they've kept you for almost a decade, I'm pretty sure that they're doing something right there. So
I want to thank you, John. Some works, Sean.
It clearly does. clearly does. So thank you so much, John. And to all our listeners who are listening in, if you've reached this far in our conversation, we want to give you a big shout out, a big thank you. And we hope that you have learned something from our chat with John Hill, evangelist at Techstars. If you're interested in the work that John does, you can go check him out on LinkedIn. He's pretty active there, always posting posts, his thoughts. If you want to go check out Techstars, they've got lots of entrepreneurship development programs happening all over the world. So go check out Techstars and the work that they do. I would highly recommend. Ladies and gentlemen, we've come to the end of our podcast session. Boniface and myself would like to say a big thank you, and we'll see you on the next one. Have an awesome day.
Hey there, folks. We're wrapping up today's episode with a quick one from our sponsors, Nepal Tea Collective. Nepal Tea is a social enterprise based in New York that distributes the freshest organically grown teas to different parts of the world, directly sourced from smallholder farmers in the beautiful country of, you guessed it, Nepal. We're proud to be sponsored by them, and at the end of our episodes, we like to wind down, and we cannot think of a better way to wind down than with a cup of hot Nepal tea. So if you'd like to check them out, go and look them up at nepalteacollective.com. That's nepalteacollective.com for more information. See you on the next one, guys.